The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm pleased to be here to introduce tonight's guest, Joe Posvansky. Arguably the best pure long-form sports writer in the land, according to the Chicago Sun-Times, Joe Posvansky is the best-selling author of six books, including in-depth accounts of golf legends Tom Watson and Jack Nicklaus, the 1975 Cincinnati Reds, and baseball coaching great Buck O'Neill. Currently a columnist for The Athletic, the co-host of the Poscast, weekly baseball podcast, very great name, and a prolific sports blogger on his popular website. He is a former columnist for Sports Illustrated and the Kansas City Star. Posvansky won two Sports Emmy Awards for his coverage of the 2014 and 2016 Olympics, and he has been honored as National Sports Writer of the Year by five separate organizations. His latest book is called The Baseball 100. In it, he tells the story of America's pastime through 100 biographies of some of the sport's greatest players. Already being hailed as an instant sports classic by the New York Post, it offers profiles of iconic Hall of Famers, unfairly forgotten all-stars, and talents of today. It also contains a foreword by George Will. Tonight's author will be joined in conversation with Tyler Kettner. The national baseball writer for the New York Times since 2010, Mr. Kettner is the author of K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches, and The Phillies Experience, a year-by-year chronicle of the Philadelphia Phillies. Joe, Tyler, thank you both so much for being here.
All right. Well, thanks. Thanks for having me. I'm honored to do this. This book is something special, as you guys all will know or know already. And certainly, as you would expect from Joe, I love the soul of baseball. I love the machine, both on my bookshelf back there. It's a pleasure knowing Joe. I was writing speaks for itself. It's the kind of writing that I always feel like the best sports writing is the kind where you feel like you've been reading it and no time has passed at all. Like it's not, it just goes down easy. I always say that about Jason Stark from Philadelphia, who is my role model and close friend. And I feel like Joe's the same way. His writing just has a style to it that, he doesn't try to overwhelm you or impress you with anything other than just great storytelling told in a easy to read way that moves along great. But we're not here to talk about writing style so much as we're here to talk about the stories. And Joe is a gifted storyteller. And let's start there, Joe, because this book is a book of rankings, but it's not a justification of the rankings. It's not like, here is why I rank this player ahead of this player. Here's how Roberto Alomar compares to Charlie Gehringer and on and on. It's I'm going to tell you a story here about Charlie Gehringer. I'm going to tell you a story about Burt Blyleven, and it might be about baseball cards. And you have no idea sort of where you're going to go with each of these 100 guys. So tell me about that process. Like, why did you decide to do it that way rather than trying to justify why you put George Brett ahead of Tony Gwynn?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you for those very kind words, and that means a lot to me. What I think of your work, you're fantastic. So maybe it'd be best to sort of start at the beginning. So this project, this idea of ranking the 100 greatest baseball players ever began when I was a little kid, but it really began about a decade ago. I came up with this idea that I was going to do for my blog. I was working at the time, maybe for Sports Illustrated, and I thought, it would be fun. I came up with kind of this cool statistical formula, which is usually where these kinds of things begin. And I thought, okay, this is a cool formula. I kind of agree with this, the way of looking at players. And I saw what the 100 looked like. You know, I ran it on a spreadsheet, and here were the 100 players. And I'm like, you know, I like this list. This is a cool list. I think what I'm going to do is I'm just going to go ahead and just every day I'm going to put out a new one. Tell you, okay, here's the 99th greatest player ever, 97th, 94th, whatever, by this formula that I came up with. And that was the entire idea. There was nothing else. I was going to do a paragraph or two about each player, probably describing exactly what you're saying, which is explaining why this person was number 79, why this person was higher than you might think or lower than you might think. And I thought that was interesting. I thought that would be a fun way to do it. And I couldn't do it. I would get to these players and I was not interested in why I'd ranked them there. I mean, it's fun to argue about, but mm-hmm. that wasn't what interested me. What interested me were the stories about these players and what they meant and why I loved them and why, you know, the role that they played in changing baseball and all of these other things. And I thought, well, that's what I want to write about. That's where I want to spend my time. So that was my idea. Like, okay, I'm going to do that. And I started doing that, and they started getting longer and longer. Mm-hmm. And of course, I had a job to, you know, so I'm doing right. this on the side, and it's mm-hmm. eating up my entire life. And we got to a point, and people who followed, and maybe there are a few of those people out there now, will remember I stopped. In the middle, I stopped at like number 30 because I just didn't have any more. I had run out of time and words and I was just done. And some people were mad as they should be. They're like, wait a minute, I followed you this whole way. And I think they soothed themselves by the fact that the entire thing was free. I think that they probably were, you know, nobody got a money back guarantee on it. But anyway, and I thought, you know, someday I'm going to come back to this. And I did, and again, you know, really wasn't the right time. And then finally, you know, this thing starts as a project with The Athletic. I had this idea. So now it's a completely different idea. Yes, it is the 100 greatest players. It does build off of a statistical formula that I came up with Tom Tango, a great baseball statistician. We came up with this great formula, but that's just the sort of spine of what this book is. What this book really is, at least for me, is a chance to tell the story of baseball, the history of baseball, why we love the game, why baseball matters. And it's through these 100 players. So they are ranked, and I'm happy if I'm sure we'll have some people that are going to want to argue about the rankings, and I'm here for it. Cause that's, mm-hmm. you don't put out a top, you know, 100 greatest without being there for the arguments, but that wasn't what it is. And that's not what this book is. The book is not an argument for these players. The book is, this person is ranked, you know, number, you know, Ichiro Suzuki's ranked number 100. Here's why Ichiro Suzuki is one of the greatest players of all time and why I love him and why he's special, and not why he just barely made the list and why he's not higher, which, you know, again, people love to argue about, and I will, but that's not what this book is.
Right. And that's one of the uncomfortable things around Hall of Fame time is that, you know, some these Hall of Fame ballots come out, and even if you take the steroid guys aside, you know, you'll have these arguments like, well, Paul Konerko is he's not a Hall of Famer because he didn't do this and that. And I'm like, Paul Konerko had, maybe he's not in the Hall of Fame, but he had one of the top 2% of right. careers of all right. time. If you were to draft Paul Konerko first in the draft, it would be a home run. You know, if you were being a little kid and had Paul Konerko's career, you'd be thrilled. But he's probably not a Hall of Famer. And then when the time comes around, you feel like you're criticizing this guy who was truly great. So what I love about this is you are taking the greatest of the great, the top 100, and not parsing it out and saying like, you know, Tony Gwynn didn't walk enough or whatever.
Well, I'll give you a great example. This is 100% right. I was just on a radio show. I was just on a radio show earlier today. This is a great example of what you're saying. And they were asking me why Derek Jeter was ranked as low as he is, which is like number, I think he's 73 maybe on this list or so, or 79. He's in that 70s. And I said, look, you know, I can tell you why he's ranked there. There are plenty of people who think he's too low. Plenty of people think he's too high. That's, you know, that's just the way it goes. But I'm not here to talk about, oh, was Derek Jeter a great fielder, right? I mean, that's, to me, Derek Jeter was just this iconic figure in the game, and this extraordinary player played on extraordinary teams. And that's the story of Derek Jeter. The story of Derek Jeter is not why he wasn't even better than he was. You know, the story of Derek Jeter is why he was so great and so iconic. And so there is one exception I do in the book. The book is, there is throughout the entire book, every essay I think is self-contained, a story, multiple stories about these players, hopefully things you don't know about some of the most famous players, hopefully an introduction to some players that you may never have heard of, but who were great, particularly in the Negro Leagues. The one exception I make is number five. And number five on this list is Oscar Charleston. It was is in my view, the greatest of all the players in the Negro Leagues, a player that a lot of people have not heard of. Maybe even some people here who are big baseball fans don't know very much about. And I tell you up front, it's the only one where I tell you up front, yes, this ranking is a challenge. It's a challenge to you. How you feel about this ranking? Is Oscar Charleston, is it an absurdity to put a Negro Leagues player that we don't know a lot of his stats about, to put him at the number five in the history of the game? Or is it an absurdity the other way, where he was probably even greater than that? I mean, so I do use that ranking as a specific challenge, but the rest of them are there to be argued outside the confines of the book. But inside the confines of the book, it's really there about telling the stories.
Right, right. Well, my favorite player of all time is Steve Carlton, and I'm glad you had him ahead of Koufax. Nothing against Koufax. He was great, but, you know, Carlton did it a whole lot longer, and he was pretty special too. You have Carlton at 63 and Koufax at 70, Robin Roberts, another great Philly, at 72, and Mike Schmidt, of course, fittingly, at number 20. And yes, you mentioned that, is that some of these, it's very inexact. Some of these, tell us why. You know, where's Joe DiMaggio, for example? I think
people, right. Well, Joe DiMaggio is number 56,
right?
Which is way lower than he is on a lot of these kinds of lists. Rightfully so, he should be higher if you're going to do it a certain way. Mm-hmm. But you know, for me, the rankings are more art than science. And there's a little trick that I'll just tell you guys because I've done a bunch of interviews now, and a lot of people have brought up DiMaggio's 56, Tom Seaver's 41, his number. Right. There's quite a few of those. Jackie Robinson is 42 on this list. So there's a lot of that in this book, but there's a little trick that I do in this book that I can tell you, since you brought up Mike Schmidt, and I know you have a close personal feeling for Mike Schmidt. So Mike Schmidt is number 20 on this list, but he's not the only 20 on this list. There are two 20s. Mike Schmidt is number 20 and Frank Robinson is number 20. They're both 20 and there's no 19 in this list. That. Yeah, there's nobody in the history of the game who's ranked 19 because of the 1919 Black Sox. So the 1919 Black Sox get their own little moment in here. Mm-hmm. Shoeless Joe is not on this list, but he gets his own little moment because there is no 19 in this book.
Yeah, you can't tell the story of baseball without that. So that was a nice little Easter egg. That was one of the fun things, I think, you know, in doing your rankings and seeing why it all came out like that. First of all, like, how many of these guys did you sort of really have to learn about? Like, I'm sure most of them, as a baseball historian, as a fan, you know a little bit about all the a little bit about everybody, but there must be some that you just didn't know a whole lot about, but they deserve to be in the top 100. Who are some of those?
Well, I would say, you know, I knew by reputation, some of the Negro Leaguers in this list. There are famous Negro Leaguers in here, like Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson and Cool Papa Bell, that I know a lot about, that a lot of people know a lot about. But I wouldn't say I knew a lot about Bullet Rogan, for example. Mm-hmm. I mean, even though I knew something, but Bullet Rogan was this Shohei Ohtani of the Negro Leagues in the 1920s, a right. great pitcher and a great hitter for the Kansas City Monarchs in the 1920s. And I didn't know a lot about him. I didn't know a lot about Pop Lloyd, who is very high on this list. And you know, there's an argument that he was the greatest shortstop in the history of baseball and played in the Negro Leagues. And they used to say he was the black Honest Wagner. And Wagner, when told that, just said, it's an honor for me to be compared to him, you know? So we're talking about one of the greatest players ever, you know, and there's a Japanese player on here, Sadaharu Oh, who I didn't know as much about as I would have liked. But I would say that even the people that I felt like I knew a lot about, like people that are, that everybody knows a lot about, Willie Mays and Henry Aaron and Ted Williams, and I still did a lot of research because I felt like those people needed something special in their essays. They needed, I wanted, if you're the most super intense fan, there might be, you know, if you're the biggest Ted Williams fan in the world, there might be a, you might not find anything in there that you're like, I kind of knew everything, but I wanted to throw something in there that even the biggest fans in the world didn't know. And I think there is stuff in the Ted Williams, just as an example, that has not been written before, about a poem that relates to him and so on. And so I wanted to do that with everybody. So even though there were a lot of players that I sort of, there were players I went in going, here's how, the best way I would say it. There are players I went in going, I knew what I was going to write about. Like I knew what was going to be the theme. And then it was going to be, you know, okay, how do I work this? How do I bring in all sorts of new things, et cetera, et cetera. But there were quite a few players that I went in going, I don't know the angle yet. I need to do some reading. A lot of these people have written books, or they wrote, or they had, you know, that they there were great stories about them in other books, or in Sports Illustrated or someplace else. And I would do a lot of reading. And then I would say, like, Carlton Fisk is one of my favorites in the book. In fact, I really believe that the Carlton Fisk essay specifically sort of helped pave the way for what this book is. I mean, it's the one that's, after I did it, I went, oh, I kind of really understand what this book is supposed to be, because it's this really beautiful but bittersweet story about him and his father, who was very hard on him and, you know, really drove him to become this extraordinary player. And then this leads all the way to his Hall of Fame acceptance, when his father's in the crowd and he speaks directly to his father, you know, which in a very beautiful way, in my view. And I thought, well, that's what this is about. I mean, this is, every one of these is a self-contained story. It's a little book inside of this person and their lives and why they matter. And so, so, you know, there was really a lot of research done on every player, but there were players like Archie Vaughn and you mentioned, you know, one, Charlie Gehringer, that I did feel like I needed to do some real research. Like what I knew about them was pretty surface, you know?
Yeah. Why Charlie Gehringer skipped his own Hall of Fame ceremony.
To get married. He skipped his own Hall of Fame thing to get married.
He didn't want to tell anybody because he was talking early, but you know. And I like how you, in the Carlton one, you really trace the, because he was so well known for not talking to the media. And that was like the thing, you know, he goes on the cover of Sports Illustrated when he wins 300. Hey, Lefty, tell us how you won 300. You know, like that was a big thing. But you trace it to how it really wasn't like one day he said, I shall stop talking right now. And it was really sort of gradual. And you only get that through meticulous research.
Yeah. And like, I did not know that. I don't know if you did. I'm a big Carlton fan. I did not know that. Mm-hmm. I kind of thought there's sort of a legend that there was one person in particular who wrote one particular story about him. And he said, that's it. I'm not talking to the media anymore. And that is absolutely not true. It's not how it happened at all. He was pretty accessible early in his career. He was somebody, he wasn't always the most jovial person to be around, but he would talk and he would answer questions. And then the story that is famously ended it for him did not. He continued to answer questions for years after that. And then it was just sort of a gradual thing where he just started, you could almost sense that for him, I mean, I wouldn't ever want to speak for anybody, certainly not Steve Carlton, but you almost got the sense for him where he was like, you know, I think I can get away without not talking to anybody. I don't think I need this. I don't think I need to do that. I think I'll be fine. And I don't, you know, I think I'll be okay. And, and once he realized that, of course, it became something that he became famous for.
Yeah. I told Derek Jeter once, I had read a Thurman Munson biography and about how Munson was very churlish with the media a lot of times. And he was a Yankee captain, and Jeter's like, wait a minute, so I'm the Yankee captain. I don't have to talk to you guys every single day. I can get away with that, really? He was just joking because he was always accessible to us. But
he was always accessible, but how many times did he say anything? That was he was a genius at, I thought, as a reporter with you often right there, at he kept it. I mean, he never said anything controversial, it just very straightforward. Yeah. But I thought great for us. I thought
There was always value in being able to get the Yankee captain in your story. He just played the game on his terms. That's all. You know, he was just going to say what he wanted to say. If you asked him an intelligent question and it wasn't going to, you know, offend anybody, he'd give you an intelligent answer, but he wasn't going to go on and give you lots of color and details because he knew what he was doing.
I find him, you know, and in my essay on him, I think I talk about this. I find him fascinating in so many ways because he was so not fascinating, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. and he was just a pro. I mean, just mm-hmm. everything he did was so professionally done, you know, in all parts of his life, obviously. But as a captain, as a player, as a teammate, he just was a pro every single day. And and it's you know, we do it. We cover the game every day. We know how long a season is and how many ups and downs there are. For somebody to be like that, to be a pro every single day, I mean, there's a reason he's a legend, and it's because that's an almost impossible thing to do.
Yeah. And speaking of pros, you know, you talk about Mike Trout, who gets, you know, sometimes gets knocked for not being more exciting or interesting or whatever. But you told a great story. You talked to his dad, Jeff, and people may not even know that his father was a very good minor league baseball player.
Yes,
and he had one of those careers that happen all the time, where circumstances, you know, wrong place, wrong time in an organization, the skills that you have are not as appreciated. Tell us a little bit about, first of all, why you chose to devote so much of the Mike Trout section to his father. Fathers and sons are a big theme in a lot of these guys' lives.
Sure.
And what you wanted to get across by telling the story of Jeff Trout, his dad.
Well, what I think is so unique about Mike Trout is Mike Trout is he's a immortal superstar who acts like the 25th guy on the team. Yeah. And how does that happen? Like, how are you that good without developing the sort of ego that comes with that? How are you that good without developing the sort of, like, I don't, you know, almost arrogance, not in a bad way, but the arrogance you need to be that big a superstar. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, he's just a guy, and it's his thing.
No entourage, no nothing.
No entourage, no, you know, he'll sign autographs quietly. He doesn't want to be on the late night shows. He doesn't want fame. He doesn't want anything. He just wants to play ball. Mm-hmm. And it became pretty clear to me as I learned the story of his dad, that it was his dad. That his dad was Mike, you know, as Jeff will tell you, I was Mike Trout without the talent. That's what he always said. And it's not true. He was a very talented player. He really was. But Jeff is, look, he's just a wonderful guy. And that family is a wonderful family. And I thought, this is at the heart of who Mike Trout is his family. He's very close to his family. He's a very much of a family guy. They text each other about the weather, which is like the funniest thing imaginable. They're all weather geeks, which is the coolest and funniest thing. And but he's this great guy. And I just talked to him. And you could tell Jeff was a little bit like, you know, and he's amazing. I mean, I actually heard from Jeff today. I mean, he's just a great, great guy. But you could tell he's like, what are you after here? You know, you could just sense. And I kept asking him about him and his career. I wasn't even asking him about, he kept kind of coming back to, like, I remember the first time I took Mike to Little League. And I'm like, no, tell me more about when you were in the minors. Yeah. Right. And you could tell he was like, he didn't quite understand where I was going with it. But I think Jeff's story is fascinating. I mean, I think Jeff's story is much more, it's much more relatable than Mike's story. Right. I mean, Mike is this, you know, he's this guy who at 19 years old, 20 years old was the best player in baseball because he was so talented and played the game so hard and all of those things. And we all see that. But Jeff, that's a story we hear all the time. Guys who was, he was the best player in college. And then he went to the minors and he was good enough. He was a great hitter and he was good enough probably to go to the major leagues, but circumstances halted him. Injuries halted him. He just wasn't, it just didn't quite work out. And what do you come, when you come out of that, who are you? Are you bitter? Are you trying to live vicariously through your son? No, none of that. He never pushed Mike into playing. He was a very passive. I mean, he was there to help him and teach him whenever he wanted to learn, but he was a very passive standby. He always said that his wife was more pushy sometimes than he was. And I think that's how you get a Mike Trout. I think Mike Trout comes, he's an unbelievable athlete. He's an unbelievable teammate. He's an unbelievable role model to me in so many ways. And I think that comes from where he came from.
Yeah, there's a lot of great stories in there about, again, about fathers and sons and you know, and you never know which way you're going to take it. Like Warren Spahn, his father named him Warren after the sitting president at the time who had just been elected, Warren Harding. And he named him himself, his middle name, Warren Edward Spicy. He gave his boy his middle name. He wanted the president to have his first name because they were very hopeful that Warren Harding was going to help the country, help his father's business. And then you go, you know, for a couple pages about all these players, Ted Lilly and Lil Stoner, and, you know, Cal McLish, who was, Tuscaloosa, Julius Calvin Coolidge is he's named after. So, you know, you have this great little tangent about random players who were named after presidents.
I love that because that's
fun stuff, and that's part of what is, I think, the romance of baseball is that, you know people who don't get it, you know, would just say, oh boy, you must have a lot of time on your hands, or you know, why should we care about this? But it's like, you know what, because that's all the silly stuff. Your favorite player was Dwayne Kuiper. I know he hit one home run in the big leagues, and if he had hit three, it wouldn't or if he hit 17, it wouldn't have been a big deal. But the fact that he hit one, is part of the romance of baseball, and you capture a lot of that in this book. I wanted to ask, speaking of fathers and sons, a very complicated guy in the current baseball discourse is Curt Schilling. He actually did get the most votes of any player on the ballot last year. I like to say he won the election, but he didn't. He didn't get the 75% needed, and he's a complicated fella. Tell us, though, the story about when you wrote about him and his late father at the 2001 World Series.
Yeah, I mean, Curt is complicated. I don't like that he gets reduced to anything else. You know, I mean, it's... as I write in there, I think he is one of two players who has won all four of Major League Baseball's like honorary awards, you know, the Lou Gehrig Award and Clemente and, you know, the awards that tell you what, you know, what kind of person you are.
Right. Jamie Moyer, the other one, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I've seen, you know, and I've seen it. I've seen him, you know, I remember when the Negro Leagues Museum needed you know, people to come out, he was there. I remember when my friend Steve the umpire who was Steve Palermo was the umpire, was paralyzed. The player who came out there to help him and support him more than anybody was Curt Schilling. He's a very interesting and complicated and troubling and fascinating individual. So I went to the World Series, I guess this was 2001, Yankees and Diamondbacks, and Curt Schilling started game one in that series. And I interviewed him before the game, and I didn't know him, but, you know, we all interviewed him. It wasn't like just me. And he was talking about his father, and he was talking, you know, and it's one of those things where a lot of us are, you know, if you're a beat guy, you're like, yeah, okay, you know, I need you to get to the meat of what you're talking about. But he was talking about his father, and he used to leave a ticket. His father was gone, but his father was the most influential person in his life, and he would leave a ticket for his father at every game that he went to. He always left a seat open for his father. And I wrote about that. He pitched this brilliant game one against the Yankees and just completely shut them down. And I wrote about it for the Kansas City Star at the time. And this was pretty, I mean, it was early days of the internet. Right. It was, nobody found you. The only people who read the Kansas City Star were people in Kansas City.
Yeah.
And I wrote it and wrote about how touching I thought it was and all that. And I went back to my hotel room and I went to bed and I woke up the next morning and I was up super early, like 6 a.m. And there was an email from Curt Schilling. He had found my email. And it was an email basically thanking me for the piece that I'd written, which I could not believe he found. I had no idea. I don't even think there was even Google then. I don't even know how he would have found it. And so we had a pretty good relationship, you know. I don't think we'd necessarily do now. I've written some pretty harsh things about him, but I think he's one of the greatest pitchers of all time. And he's on this list. I think if when it came to big games, I think you and I are pretty skeptical about some of the things that are, you know, narrative type stuff that go on out there. But, you know, when you pitch in many great big games as he did, there's something there. I mean, he was a true big game pitcher. He was a guy that delivered in the biggest moments and he's on this list and, you know, the complicating parts of him are they're in the essay, but also the greatness of him is in the essay as well.
Yeah. You give these guys there too, Bonds and all of them and Clemens.
Of course.
You know, yeah. By the way, that's one of Schilling's big moments right there. You can see that's game five of the 93 World Series.
There you go.
The Blue Jays.
Who knew? I mean, he was so young then. Who knew that he had this in him, you know, at that point?
So we have a lot of questions here and I want to get to them. So thanks for everybody for contributing questions and keep them coming. So let's go to the top one. Dan Lloyd says, of all the players featured, which is the one that has consistently received the strongest objection for being included in the book from readers? In other words, who is the guy who, you know, people say, come on, he's not a top 100.
Right. I would say it's kind of a landslide. And I would have guessed there'd be several. Like when I put Blylevin as high as I did, I would have thought there were people that don't believe Blylevin was as great as he is. I had Carlos Beltran in there. There'd be people that, particularly after the Houston scandal, they would say, he doesn't belong. But the guy who clearly I've gotten the most for is Mike Mussina. Mike Mussina is number 99 on this list. And I felt very strongly, and still do feel very strongly, he's one of the 100 greatest players ever. But he also is, as we all know, as you know, as well as anybody, a guy who, you know, fell short on so many things in his career, right? Like he never won a World Series and he didn't win 20 until his last year. And he had almost no hitters, you know, like throughout. And he always was like second best. Like that was always the thing. Never won a Cy Young. But he was so great for those times. And there's just this long stretch of time when he was brilliant and great. But there are a lot of people who would be like, that doesn't make sense to me, you know? And I think one of the things that's really fascinating about any kind of list like this is that we carry over our feelings and they never go away. So like if somebody wins an MVP, they're, even if you kind of feel at the time like, somebody else probably should have won that MVP, it doesn't matter. The MVP lasts forever, and there'll always be those that will, you know, use that. And if you don't win a Cy Young, there were a couple of times that I think that Mike Mussina should have won the Cy Young, and he didn't win it. Somebody won it over him. But nobody goes back and looks at that. All they see is he didn't win a Cy Young. So I think that carries over into reputation. But in my view, you know, look, there were so many players that I wanted to include on this list that are not. There are so many players out there that I think are some of the greatest of all time and would have been so much fun to write about. But I think Mike Mussina belongs on the list.
Yeah, I do too. Linda Teal and also later Chris Goring asked a similar question about who would have been number 101. Is there anyone you wish you could have included but could not justify. And I would ask, you know, did you end up writing a couple of 102, 103 and had to sort of choose which to put in or which, who was on the cutting room floor?
Well, there are a bunch of people on the cutting room floor, and there are a bunch that I've thought about sort of stretching it out and writing like 110 down because I so badly want to write about them. Yeah. And one of those I really want to write about is that I think is just missed the list is Joey Votto, Cincinnati's Joey Votto. Mm-hmm. And that is not only because Joey Votto himself has told me he should be on the list. It's also because I think he's one of the all-time greats. But I can tell you 101 because I have actually announced to in the book, I even tell you who number 101 is. Number 101 is a Negro Leagues player named Turkey Stearns, who it was just gut-wrenching for me to leave him off this list. He is truly one of the greatest players of all time. I don't know who I could have taken out to put him in, but he was an incredible power hitter. They called him Turkey because of the way he ran. He was this wonderful character who used to carry his bats around in like violin cases or bass cases and would talk to his bats. He carried a bunch of different kinds and he would talk to them. And he was this wonderful character, but he was also this amazing power hitter. And he was number 101.
Okay. Ralston Cranford says, can you tell us more about the stats and algorithm you use to make the determinations? Loves this discussion. Can't wait to receive his copy.
Thank you. Yeah. Yes, I can tell you a little bit more. It's not so much, I mean, I can't go in to the statistical specifics, not because of any, you know, secretive or whatever, but because I just don't understand them. I mean, there was Tom pretty much handled the number elements of these things. But here's what I wanted. And this is what Tom and I talked about. I wanted, you know, Tom is the one who invented wins above replacement. So he is the person who fully, you know, understands that whole, it's not a statistic, but like a measure, you know, how to measure player. And his big idea with WAR is that everybody can have their own personal wins above replacement. It's just what you value. So if you value defense more than offense, you can jack up that part of it. If you value power more than on base, you can jack up that part of it. It's all what you value. And so when we came up with this, I told him what I valued. And here's what I value. I value players who are well-rounded. That was really important to me. I wanted players that could do everything. As much as you can, you know, do everything. There are not that many five-tool players in the history of the game, but as much as you can, do everything. I valued the time when they played. That was really important to me. What, interestingly, on every other kind of sport, I'm actually doing a football countdown. And in football, we'll see how that goes. But that's a whole other conversation because it's much, much more difficult challenge in a lot of ways. But in football, in basketball, maybe not as much in hockey, but certainly in football and basketball, there's a tremendous recency bias. There just is, you know, it's like, you know, these players are bigger and stronger and jump higher than the players ever did. And there's a tremendous recency bias. In baseball, it's the exact opposite. There's a tremendous recency, the opposite. They people like the older players. You look at these lists. Even my list is really geared toward very, you know, players that have not played in 50 years. And almost all these lists are. You look at these lists in the top 25 players, you'll be like, well, I didn't see any of these people play because I'm, you know, 35 years old and nobody from my era is in this list. And it was, I don't like that at all, not just because I think it's boring, but also because I think some of the greatest players in baseball history are playing right now, this very minute. I mean, we might be watching the greatest hitter in the history of the game in Juan Soto. We don't know yet, but we really might be watching the greatest hitter in the history of the game right there. So he came up with a statistical formula that sort of measured quality of play in the leagues so that you dominating dead ball, dominating the 20s, dominating the 30s, dominating the 50s, and so on. There was a different score for each of those kinds of things. And then dominating or being a great player in the last 20 years, was the highest. It was the highest score, you know, and I think that's the way it should be. So those were two of the biggest things that I looked at that would be different from, I think, what most people look at, which is I really wanted well-rounded players. Larry Walker is on this list, for example, because I feel like he's a guy that was incredibly well-rounded. And then trying to really capture the era that the player was in, I think, was really important to me.
Yeah, definitely. John Cola writes, hey, Joe, the Baseball 100 was one of the greatest things I have ever read, and I can't wait to get the book and reread it frequently. Thank you. It was a decade in the making, but well worth the wait. My question is, were there any players that you weren't necessarily a big fan of, that the story you wrote made you a bigger fan of that player? For John, it was Frank Robinson. He said he didn't know a ton about him other than the stats and stuff. And the story you wrote is amazing and one of my favorite things you ever wrote. Thanks for doing this. Congratulations. So anybody who you came to like more as a fan, perhaps, in this writing process?
Very interesting question. I'm trying to think. Like, there were certain players that I wrote about who I found myself even more fascinated by them as I started writing. I mean, look, I didn't have any, I mentioned Carlton Fisk before. I didn't have any negative feelings whatsoever about Carlton Fisk, but I didn't have necessarily, he was just another great player. And when I started writing about him and hearing his story and reading his story and investigating his story, I did like him more, a lot more. He was a guy that I just found to be really solid and fascinating in so many ways. You know, most of these players I really like. I mean, I make a big thing about being an anti-Derek Jeter guy. Like, that's been my shtick for a long time. I invented the word Jeterate, which is a verb that means to give credit to somebody for something that they do not deserve credit for. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Jeter always got credit for things that other people did as well. But I've always liked him. And I would say that writing about him gave me a new and more powerful appreciation for what he was. And one thing I say about Derek Jeter in here that I don't know that I would have ever said before is there is no doubt in my mind that Derek Jeter was underrated in his career. Mm-hmm. Which is such a weird thing because he was obviously overrated. I mean, everybody knows, right? Like, that's the whole thing. He was a Yankee. He'd gone somewhere else, this and that and the other. But one of the true weird things in baseball history is that Derek Jeter never won an MVP. That's a weird thing. I mean, he could have won three of them, four of them, you know? I mean, he was right in the mix. How he didn't win the MVP in 98 is beyond my belief. And he didn't come that close. But He's the captain and had an unbelievable year for the great 1998 Yankees, and he didn't win the MVP. He didn't finish second. I mean, it's really weird. So yeah. I mean, I'd say I gained an appreciation for a lot of players that I didn't necessarily dislike. I don't know that there's a player on here that I dislike. Maybe Ty Cobb is a guy that you know, I kind of went in, you know, knowing that you know, who among us likes Ty Cobb, right? And then you find out, you know, that, you know, you do research and you realize that there's a whole group of people who make a very compelling case that he was completely misunderstood and was a much different person than his reputation. And then you sort of say, oh, well, you know what? Ty Cobb actually wasn't that bad a guy. And then you have the counter people who are like, oh no, he was every bit as bad as we said in the first place. So finding who Ty Cobb was kind of fun.
Yeah. David Bradley says, Tyler and Joe, thank you so much for your great writing and care for the game. Thank you, David. Joe, this project has allowed you to hold simultaneously the continuity and changes of the game over time. I'm interested with the perspective you have, your thoughts on the proposed changes to the game, such as pitch clock, banning the shift, robo umps, which would alter some long running constants.
Well, I do see it a little bit differently than that. I think sometimes you have to make changes in order to get the continuity of the game. You know, like, I think there's something when you talk about the continuity of the game, and I thought a lot about this, and it's a great question and a great thought. But the game takes a half an hour longer now than it did 25 years ago, every game. So no rule change came along that made it so. It's the players started playing at a much, much slower pace, and they started stepping out more. And of course, more pitchers came in the game, and lots of things happened to change the game. And there were no rules to counter those changes. So a pitch clock is just an example of those things. Very well might return the game to more of a, you know, the continuity of what it was, you know, I mean, the more of the game that we grew up with. And so I do think about that. I think about rules that, I mean, nobody hits triples anymore in the game.
Right?
No triples. We love triples. Triples is one of the most exciting, maybe the most exciting. Buck O'Neill always said the most exciting part of the game is a triple. And there are no triples in the game. Now, is the continuity of the game to just let the triple die, or is it to maybe figure out a way to encourage the triple again? I don't know exactly how you do that. I mean, there are lots of different thoughts about putting more balls in play and doing different things. But again, I think a lot about that. I don't like banning the shift as an example. Okay. And I don't like it for a couple of reasons. One, it feels fake to me in a way that the pitch clock doesn't. Pitch clock is just like, okay, look, pitch faster. Your job is to pitch faster. And I'm fascinated by the minor league pitch clock of what, 15 seconds, right? Where they're really moving them along.
And it's working. It's making
and it's
the game.
Working. It's
Jason
working.
Stark has written in The Athletic very about that. Yeah.
And it's a great story. And I hope everybody reads it, because Jason, you know, makes this point that it brought a lot back into the game, more than they expected, right? And they didn't just speed up the game. It did put more balls in play. And there was all sorts of cool side things that came with it. But that just speed up the game. But the problem with banning the shift is you are saying to your defense, you know where they're going to hit the ball. You're not allowed to stand there. And I think that's crippling the game in a way that I don't think is right. That's the one reason I don't like it. But the second thing is, I don't think it makes that big a difference. It does on a sort of visual standpoint. I think none of us like when we see a hard ground ball up the middle that was a base hit for 100 years now just being, you know, scooped up by the third baseman who happened to be standing there or whatever. I don't think we love that, but you know, if you know they're going to hit the ball up the middle, I mean, it almost, you wonder why in the heck they weren't playing it that way before. They didn't have the same information. So, you know, I want to see ways to bring the game back, and I'm not sure that's one, but I'm open to reviewing every rule. I think every single rule that we can use to try to bring the game a little bit back, to pull it back, to get more balls in play, to get fewer strikeouts, to bring base running back into the game, to do a lot of these things that we love about baseball, to me would be wonderful.
Yeah. I like that way to look at it. Like, we're not trying to change the game. We're trying to change little bits of the game to make the whole more recognizable,
right,
to what it should be or what it traditionally has been. So that's a great perspective on it. Let's run through some more. Betty Lawson asks, she says, you probably get this a lot, but please share a favorite Buck O'Neill story, maybe one that didn't make it into your book with him. I think of the way you lead your Oscar Charleston chapter. You may not want to give that away, but anyway, Buck O'Neill story.
Well,
you wrote a whole book about him. So
I did. And what threw me was one that didn't make it into the book. I put all of the best stories into the book. There is a story, I don't know if I put it in the book. It's more of a personal story. I don't know if people will enjoy it or not. But after, you know, so in February of 2006, he was up for the Hall of Fame. And it looked and seemed like he was going to go in. They had put together an entire panel to put in as many Negro Leaguers as they thought were, you know, belonged in the Hall of Fame. And they put 17 in, but they didn't put Buck in. And, you know, it was a real shot. I mean, a lot of us felt, some people did not, but some people felt it was really unfair to Buck O'Neill. And Buck, of course, took it with all of the, grace and humble nature of, that he is. You know, I remember I was in the room with him when he found out he wasn't going to be going into the Hall of Fame. And he immediately said, well, that's the way the cookie crumbles. I mean, that was his actual words that he said when he found out. It was just, that's just the kind of person he was. And he went downstairs, we were at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in Kansas City, and he went downstairs and gave this very impassioned press conference where people kept, you know, there was a lot of angry reporters and they were asking him how, you know, how could they do this to you kind of thing. And he was basically just saying, you know, don't, everybody's trying their best. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about old Buck. You know, the fact that you care is what matters to me. I mean, it was very sweet. So the next day I was in a bookstore and my phone rang and it was Buck, and Buck never called me. I mean, this was a very unusual thing. So I looked and I saw it was Buck O'Neill. I think, I don't even know if we had caller ID then. But I answered it and it was Buck. And I said, oh, hi Buck. And he said, hey, can you do me a favor? And I said, sure. And he said, can you write something tomorrow telling people how much I appreciate? Because the last 24 hours, I've just been getting love from all over the country and all over the world. And it means so much to me that people care about this old guy. And it just matters so much to me. And I want people to know that just being in their Hall of Fame is all I ever wanted. And it was very, very sweet. And I said, of course I would, Buck. And then there was this long pause on the phone. And then Buck said, did I tell you about the guy who came up to me? Because this was after I had done all the research in the book. And he said, did I tell you about the guy who came up to me and asked, who's that white guy that keeps following you around everywhere you go? And I said, no, Buck, what did you say? And Buck said, I said, he's my son. You know, for me, that is the Buck story. I cherish that. I think about it all the time. He was just an incredible, extraordinary person. And I hope if you enjoy the Baseball 100 or even don't, that you pick up The Soul of Baseball, because it is my love letter to Buck and the most special book I'll ever write in so many ways.
Wow. Yeah, no, it is a special one. A fellow named John Kepner, who happens to be my father, my dad, he said, how do you evaluate pitching versus position players in determining the rankings? Do you weigh one over the other when it's close?
It's a good question, Mr. Kepner. You should be very proud of your son. He's awesome. It is a great question. Here's the thing. I just mentioned a few minutes ago that I'm doing a football 100. And the thing that's fascinating is comparing pitchers to hitters is nothing like comparing a left tackle to a free safety.
Oh,
to a
wow. Yeah.
Right? Right. You know, it's like in so many ways, baseball is easier that way. It's hard. There are statistical ways that you can sort of figure out the value of pitchers and hitters. You know, you do use different kinds of wins above replacement that kind of give us a little bit of a balancing act. But honestly, I think it's, again, to me, it's a little bit more art than science. I knew there were going to be a certain number of pitchers in here. I don't know that I hit that number exactly, but I knew that, like, look, pitchers are, you know, whatever, 30% of the game, 28% of the game, 25% of the game, 35%, whatever it is. And so there were going to be that many pitchers, or at least that many pitchers in this thing. And so I did rank them separately at one point, and put the pitchers in a certain order and the hitters in a certain order, and then tried to intersperse them. But then, you know, Tom came up with this formula that I think did a really nice job of balancing them. And so, you know, I think the pitchers are in, you know, sort of in the places where I think they belong. And again, some of it is, you know, pitchers. Satchel Paige is number 10 on this list. He could have been number one, frankly. I mean, he could have been anywhere on that list, depending on how you value pitchers. But I thought number 10 was the right place for him. And so I did that kind of thing, you know, where I just really tried to match the person up with the place that I thought they belonged.
You nailed it for the highest ranked pitcher at Walter Johnson. I've always thought that.
There
too.
You go.
Poor Randy. He's one of the 20 best players ever. He's not even the best player pitcher with his last name. Same last name. I just talked to him recently. He's a lot of fun.
Character. Yeah.
Yeah. We're winding down here, but I'll get to Andy's question. He says, in his historical baseball abstract, Bill James did a top 100 based on peak performance and another based on career performance. To what extent did you, in arriving at your rankings, focus more on peak or career or a combination? And in that regard, is there a player who had a great peak, but it was too short to make the top 100, or a player who had great counting numbers, but not a dominant enough peak? And finally, has Bill James, who we all know has strong opinions, shared his thoughts on your rankings?
Well, boy, there's a mouthful there and a lot to talk about. Great questions, all of them. Let me start with the Bill James question. Yes, I went to dinner with Bill James last night.
Wow.
Bill and I are doing an event in Kansas City tomorrow. I'm in Kansas City. I'm in a hotel room right now. So we are doing an event tomorrow. So I have purposely not asked him anything about the Baseball 100 because I want him to save it for tomorrow. But I know, knowing Bill is going to be very blunt and honest and tell me exactly what he thinks about the list. Bill is obviously, in addition to being a great friend, he's a role model. This list is, this book is an homage to him in so many ways, you know. The peak and career thing is the exact right question to ask. It's the lifeblood of any kind of list like this, because I value peak. And that, by the way, that was the third thing that I put in, that Tom Tango put into the formula, was putting a little more emphasis on peak than career. I mean, that was really important to us, was to, you know, because I think sometimes we overdo it on career. You know, it's like, oh, this guy was great until he was 32, but then he didn't have three average years after that to sort of push up his numbers. That's how Dale Murphy is. I think Dale Murphy belongs in the Hall of Fame, but Dale Murphy did not have even an average year after age 31 or 32. And so he didn't get to 400 homers. He didn't get to some of these things, which I don't feel like should be, if he'd hit 25 more home runs in a sort of a mediocre years at the end of his career, that to me doesn't make him any more or less a Hall of Famer, I think. So I did want to value peak more, but at the same time, yes, there are several players who had incredible peaks who are not on this list. And, you know, maybe number one of all of them is the guy who I think had incredibly short peak, way too short, is Dwight Gooden. I think you can make a very strong argument that 84, 85 Dwight Gooden is as good as any pitcher in the history of the game. I mean, you know, his 85 year is beyond belief. His 84 year was his rookie year was incredible. And he was still very good in 86. And then he started falling off and he did not quite end up doing quite enough, in my view, to make the Hall of Fame or to make this list. But his peak was extraordinary, right? It was just at the very top. If somebody was like the best player in baseball for 3 years, 3 or 4 years, they're probably on this list. I mean, you know, because it's like, if you're that good a player for that, you know, even that short a period of time, you're one of the all-time greats, I think. So I don't know of anybody that had like, hey, they were the best player in baseball for 3, 4, 5 years. I mean, you could argue that Don Mattingly was, or Dale Murphy was, or whatever, but I don't know that the statistics would always back you on that.
Yeah, it was probably Ricky Henderson or Wade Boggs.
Right. Exactly. You know, exactly. Who are both obviously on this list.
Yes. And the Wade Boggs chapter is fascinating. Cause I liked him a lot back in the day. And you're right about how people, he was never underrated. He was always a star. Everybody knew.
Sure.
But like no one quite got him. No one quite got what he brought to the teams. And, yeah. And he was quirky for sure. And there was a lot of some off fields. But anyway, but all that stuff is fascinating in this. Great book. We'll close because it's already after 8:30. Or we're just about 8:30, 8:31. So Dave Osborne says, Joe and Tyler, wondering what your go-to ballpark food and drink is. I'm asking this as I'm watching the Phillies eating a dog with a crowd and drinking a Budweiser. This has been fantastic. Thanks a lot. That sounds pretty good, Dave. I think that's you might want to keep drinking. Looks like the Braves are winning 2-0 in the top of the fifth. Phillies, as we know, kind of need a sweep in this series. But, you know, maybe there'll be a second Budweiser for you. Joe, why don't you go for this one?
Well, I mean, look, I've nothing wrong with a dog and a beer. I don't see anything wrong. It's interesting. I have a very, I don't know how you feel about this. I mean, there are some amazing ballpark food parks, right? I mean, San Francisco has amazing food. You go to Pittsburgh and get a Primanti sandwich. It's amazing. And all that, but you know, I grew up in Cleveland. And for me, a hot dog with mustard, particularly Stadium Burtman mustard, is what I want. So there's a part of me that wants to separate food from baseball. Like I love the idea of like these places where you can just get these exotic things. I love going to Kansas City and having barbecue or whatever. But there's a part of me that's like, yeah, you go to the ballpark, I want a beer, I want a dog, I want nachos, you know, I want the traditional stuff. So I'll go and I don't know how you feel. I will counter the question directly to you, Tyler. Are Dodger dogs, which are the most famous dogs probably in baseball, are Dodger dogs overrated?
Yes.
Yeah, I think they're right.
I think that there's a lot there because they're all foot longs or they're all pretty long. But I,
right,
you know, and if you're really hungry when they serve them up in the press box in the seventh inning, whenever they put that as sixth inning, you might need a little snack. Then you go for it. But I don't know. I'm not just playing in the home crowd, but I'm from there, and I was in Philly a couple weeks ago for the Saturday game against the Rockies, and I just wanted two hot dogs and they were great.
Yeah.
Philly's Franks. I was raised on them. I love them. And then, now you add in the crab fries from Chickies and Pete's that they have there. And even my daughter was there for her first game there. And she was like, oh my God, these crab fries are amazing. My son who's now in college in BC. He would walk a mile for crab fries. I mean, like, so yeah, the crab fries and the Philly's Franks and we could cheat a little bit in the media because we have that, Frank who does the ice cream in the press box in Philly is a legend, and Philly has the best ice cream selections too of any ballpark I know, or at least in the press box. But yeah, and I gotta put in a plug for Boog's barbecue pit in Baltimore, the turkey barbecue sandwich, whatever he's got there. And we can go up on the suite level so we don't have to wait in the huge line in right field. But a great game in Baltimore. Baltimore's obviously in a lull now, but when they fill that place up and you can see the smoke coming from Boogs out there,
it's awesome.
It's like the new original, which is at Camden Yards. I mean, you know, Fenway.
I love it.
It's so great. It's the first, really the first one of that incredible wave. You could say Comiskey, but they didn't quite get that. It's really Camden Yards that just inspired all these amazing ballparks. And you know, you do the same thing that, you know, when you tour cover this game now, the quality of every ballpark is just terrific
everywhere except Tampa,
except although it's the best place to work, so that's
it, is place to work. It's a good place to work.
yeah and maybe Oakland. I don't know what Oakland's going for it, except the fans there are great. I think we got a couple more questions about number 101. But we've already answered that. You know, Turkey Stearns, you know, you can read about Turkey Stearns somewhere and remember what Joe told you about him there. Dice K. Nakai says, Shadow Ball, what were you trying to do with the Shadow Ball series that you did for the original 100 list? He said it might be a little niche, but that's our last question. So I'll have you answer that.
Perfect. Yeah, no, Shadow Ball was part of, so I said at the very start, I talked about when I first did this thing and I was going to be this list. And then I tried a second list. And the idea in the second one was I was going to do two different lists. One was going to be the 100 greatest major league players ever. And then I was going to have this shadow ball list, which was going to be the 100 greatest, I don't even know how you would describe it, people who were not major league players, but were incredibly important to the game. So that was going to have Negro leaguers in it. It was going to have managers in it. It was going to have fictional characters in it. It was going to have like all this, like I started like it. That. I remember like I did a whole essay on Who from the first.
Mighty Casey, I'm sure, is in there.
Yes, exactly. There was a very long Roy Hobbs breakdown, yeah. And you know, so I was going to do all of these different things, but when I did this, and I loved it, I loved that, and I still am fascinated by the idea of doing this 100 greatest characters list, and I don't know if people would be as interested in that, but the thing is, the problem was that I was separating out great players like Negro Leagues players, and that's not right. I mean, I didn't want that. The Negro Leagues players, it was the most important thing in the world to me was that they were in this list. And so that's why I had to put Shadow Ball away, but I did love the Shadow Ball idea.
Yeah. I like what George Will says in the intro here, quoting you, that said, if you ever find yourself wondering about the quality of the players in the Negro Leagues, think about this. If Aaron Williams and McCovey had been born, Billy Williams, 20 years earlier, all three of them, who were all born in Mobile, Alabama, all three of them would have spent their primes in the Negro Leagues, and their stories would be told as legend. People would be telling tall tales about the power of Stretch McCovey and the impossibly quick bat of Henry Aaron, or the gorgeousness of Billy Williams hitting. And would you believe it? I wouldn't worry about people overrating Negro Leaguers. I'd worry about people underrating them. And that, I never thought about it in that, quite that way, that if Aaron and all those guys, Aaron McCovey and them, were 20 years older, that they'd be, you know, these legendary guys, and we'd be thinking, oh, were they really all that great? You know, and it's like, oh yeah, no, they let's not underrate these Negro League legends. To have a Dr. Turnelson at number five, and you know, to read some of these stories about Cool Papa Bell and Page and Gibson and the rest of them, it's
I'll leave you with this because it's along those lines. When Barry Bonds came to the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in Kansas City, I wrote a column basically imagining what would have been like if Barry Bonds had played in the Negro Leagues. And what would we know about Barry Bonds today, right? Like we all have saw about Barry Bonds. We all saw how impossibly great he was as a hitter, especially after he bulked up, naturally and unnaturally. But the speed, the defense, everything else that he did. And if he had done that in 1929, and there were all of these stories about him, and that's all you heard were these legends about Barry Bonds, would you believe it? And that's what I wrote. I wrote, you know, would you even believe that a player like Barry Bonds could exist? If would you believe that a player like Ken Griffey Jr. could exist? You know, would you believe that a player like Albert Pujols could exist if all you heard about them was legend? And Barry Bonds, to his credit, Barry was not always the easiest, as we all know, to work with or deal with. But he said that he read that and he started to cry, and it meant a lot to him. And he went through the Negro Leagues Museum with a different approach, he said, because he thought about that. He thought about what it would have been like if, you know, that some of these guys might have been better than him. And you might remember, nobody loved when he broke Henry Aaron's home run record, obviously, for a lot of reasons. But when he broke it, he said, I don't consider myself to have the record. I think Josh Gibson has the record. And I think that's special and right. You know, it's the right way to think about it.
Yeah, that's part of what makes this book so great, is you give Bonds his due without overlooking, you know, the other side of him. You basically have two Bonds essays. You don't overlook the negatives about Clemens, but you also acknowledge that he was one of the greatest pitchers of all time.
Right.
You know, and history, as you know, is complicated, and that doesn't mean that it's bad or anything. It just means that you just need to apply context to this stuff. You can't be afraid of a guy like Clemens. All that stuff happened. Just put it in context. And that's what historians like you do in this great book, Baseball 100. Can't recommend it enough. You all probably have it, or you should get it real soon. So I don't really, I guess that's about it, right? 8:30.
I think we're good. This was awesome.
So, hey, thanks. Thanks a lot. And you guys can go back to watching the Phillies there. They're in Philadelphia. It's, still 2-0 in the bottom of the fifth. Some good pennant race action right now. And I'm sure Joe and I will be catching up on it ourselves. So thank you, everybody. This was an honor for me. I love Philadelphia. The library there has been great to me and Joe as well. Joe, good luck on your publicity tour for this. And, you know, I hope it rockets to the top of the bestseller list, because you deserve it, man. Great job.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thanks, everybody, for joining us.
Night, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.